Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the Book of Chronicles, the first Book of Chronicles, chapter 7. We're still going through an extremely difficult portion of Scripture because, like I said, the first 9 chapters alone, I mean, we're dealing with all these genealogies and these places and these names. There's over 500 different names that are compiled here. And it's a portion of Scripture where virtually nobody reads, nobody studies, nobody preaches on, right? For good reason. I mean, you wonder why is it even in the Scriptures. And then when you're going through a lot of these names and these genealogies, I'm just trying to put it together the best that I can in terms of I see this as most likely it was Ezra, the scribe, when he was in Babylon. You know, he was born there in captivity, and yet he was part of the priestly line, and he really devoted himself to knowing God and serving God and reading his word and studying his words. And I think that he's the one to compile so much of this, because I really believe that he saw the importance of doing this in terms of people knowing what tribe they were from, especially when it came to the priest, because you could not function as a priest unless you could prove your genealogy in terms of coming from the tribe of Levi, and especially the priests who were offered sacrifice or incense. They had to be direct descendants of Aaron. As a matter of fact, when we went through the book of Nehemiah, maybe it was Ezra, but I think it was Nehemiah, when they did come back from their captivity, there were some people there who they could not say for sure whether they were of the priestly tribe. And so it said that they were going to use the Urim and the Thummim to determine what tribe they belonged to, because that's why that was so important. By the way, you know, do you know what the Urim and Thummim happened to be? I know I went over this not too long ago, but do you guys remember what the Urim and Thummim was?
Breast piece of the high priest. And they would use it to determine somehow the Lord's answer to questions.
Yeah, the high priest had this breastplate, and it was actually a breastpiece that you had 12 stones on it, okay, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. But there were two pouches behind this breastplate, and it had, and in them they had the Urim and the Thummim. And by those two stones that they would cast, and they would determine what God's will was. Now, this has been totally lost in antiquity, totally. We have no idea really what it looked like and how it functioned. But I drew some diagrams there that have of my own, let's say, conception of what it was like. I just believe that they were like two gems that had all these different facets on them in terms of different sides to them. And on each side, they would have a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And there was 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And they probably had a yes and a no, and probably had a blank spot. And that's just totally speculative, right? But this is the way the high priest would determine God's will, is he would actually cast him as lots to determine. And apparently, even to determine if a person didn't know their genealogy, if they didn't know for sure if they were a priest, it was so important that they can determine this one way, shape, or form or another before they can function as a priest. But I only bring that out to, you know, to just mention that in passing, because we look at this, we say, well, for some reason, God had this put here. And I think that one of the main reasons is that people needed to have an idea of, you know, even though they were exiled, they needed to know what tribe they were from. Now, most Jews today, probably all the Jews today, probably couldn't tell you what tribe they're from. But obviously, God knows exactly what tribe each person is from. And we read in the book of Revelation, read in chapter 7, at the very beginning of the tribulation period, it looks like what's going to happen there is, I believe, this is speculative, but I believe, I put it all together, I believe that these two prophets are going to come on the scene. I know for sure one of them is Elijah, the prophet, and it appears, in my opinion, the other one is Moses. And I think that their first order of business when the tribulation starts is to get the 144,000 Jews saved. And then it mentions 12,000 from each tribe, and it mentions each tribe by name. So what I'm saying is that God hasn't forgot what tribe everybody's from. But I know that I've shared this in earlier chapters going through First Chronicles, but I just want to reiterate this simply because this genealogy can get so confusing. And I use this as an example. This is totally made up on my part, but just imagine now, and I just wrote this thing down called the Seeds of Confusion. And now I said, now just imagine this, okay? You got a guy named Kevin, who's the son of George. He marries Sue, the daughter of John. Kevin and Sue have a son and name him Mike. But Kevin dies, or Kevin and Sue divorce. Then Sue marries a guy by the name of Tom, the son of Lee. And then Tom becomes the stepfather of Mike and the son of Kevin, and the grandson of George. And then Sue and Tom have two children together. The first they named George after Mike's grandfather, and the second they named John after Sue's father. Then Mike automatically becomes the stepbrother of both George and John, who are the sons of Tom, the son of Lee, and Sue, the daughter of John. Mm-hmm. And then I just wrote this. Now, in just one or two generations, a person's family tree can become so confusing. Just imagine how convoluted a person's family tree can become when you try to piece together genealogies dating back thousands of years, where families often consisted of multiple wives and numerous siblings and half-brothers and sisters and different descendants with the same name. Now, I just say that. We can see how things can get so confusing just within one or two generations, right? And especially when people name their kids after themselves. I mean, and that can really get confusing if you're trying to, you know, decipher this 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. So I just throw that out there because I read this stuff and I go, man, this can really get confusing. And I really believe that the way Ezra, or the one who compiled all these different names, they, to make matters even worse, it seems like their intention is to just put it in blocks to where a number of people could easily be missing. And then when people have the same names, then it really can get confusing. So just keep that in mind, because now he's going to be dealing with Issachar in the first five verses of this Chronicles chapter 7. But anybody remember who Issachar is? Going back to Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob is giving his final blessings to his 12 sons, Issachar, it actually means wages. And that was a situation where you had this almost like this population war going on between Leah and Rachel. And so Issachar, you know, he was one of Jacob's sons, but he was also from his wife Leah. All right, and it basically meant wages, that God would give her wages. But, you know, in Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob was basically giving his last words or his last testimony, his last benediction, his last blessing to his sons, and he said this of Issachar. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. And I don't know if you can even see it on a map here, but he's right there, around almost in the center of the nation of Israel. And apparently, what this prophecy was made in regard to Issachar, he became a very, very industrious person, him and his descendants, in terms that they really worked hard. But this is what it says in Chronicles chapter 7 in regards to Issachar. He says, now the sons of Issachar were four: Tola, Puah, Jashub, and Chimron. The sons of Tola were Uzai and Rephaiai and Jeriel and Jammai, Issam, and Samuel, heads of their father's households. The sons of Tola were mighty men of valor in their generations. Their number in the days of David was 22,600. The sons of Uzai was Isharia. The sons of Isharia were Michael and Obadiah and Joel and Ishia. All five of them were chief men. With them, by their generations, according to their father's household, were 36,000 troops of the army for war, for they had many wives and sons. Their relatives among all the families of Issachar were mighty men of valor, enrolled by genealogy in all 87,000. Now, like I said, to most people, this is just a lot of useless information, but just naming some of the descendants of Issachar, I think it's kind of interesting that this first guy he mentions, he is Tola. It appears that he was one of the judges of Israel, because if you go back to Judges chapter 10, it says this: now after Abimelech died, Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, arose to save Israel, and he lived in Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim. He judged Israel 23 years, then he died and was buried in Shamir. This Tola, apparently he was one of the judges of Israel, because it tells you that in Judges 1, where it says Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo. This particular man from the tribe of Issachar really exemplified himself before God and before men as far as judging Israel for that number of time. But then they list here the number of fighting men that they had, especially during the time of David, and it says 22,600. Now, when I'm looking at these figures, and it's probably no big deal, but if you go back to Numbers chapter 1, they have actually a census there. And they what they do in that census is that they would basically count every able-bodied man for war, beginning with age 20 and ending at age 50. Now, what if you look on this chart that I made here, when they first took a census, when they first came out of Egypt, it says that Issachar had 54,400 fighting men. Well, that's just the men of war from 20 years old and up, okay, from 20 years old to 50. That's the draft age. But then, because of their disobedience, because they refused to go into the promised land, well, then 40 years later, this was one of the few tribes, Issachar, that actually had an increase. Because on the second census, they had 64,300 men, which was actually around almost an 18% increase. A number of tribes, they were huge, and then by the time they got into the promised land, their numbers had been greatly reduced, right? And some of them increased, others decreased. But you look at these figures here, well, these figures that they gave are even higher figures than we're reading here. That verse 5 in this chapter 1 of 1 Chronicles 7, says their relatives among all the families of Issachar were mighty men of valor, enrolled by genealogy in all 87,000. And my point is this: I don't know if they're including all the men of Issachar at the time of David. This is speculative on my part, but I believe that probably what happened there was that they didn't draft everybody at 20. Between 20 and 50. They just simply had, you know, a selective army, right? But I think what's also important about that is, too, is that, you know, why did they emphasize this? Why did they emphasize men of war when it comes to these tribes? Because this is divinely inspired. What's the spiritual significance to this?
Isn't it people willing to fight for the Lord?
Yeah, you got to take it to the spiritual level, because we are told in Ephesians chapter 6 that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against all these spiritual forces in heavenly places, right? This is the real warfare that's going on. You see all the wars that are going on in the world right now? Wars and insurrections and revolutions that are going on all over this planet, right? But the epic center of all wars is spiritual. It really is spiritual. We are in a knockdown, drag out battle with the forces of darkness. And I really believe that when we're reading things like this, God does put a premium on what? On men of war. Now, take that to the spiritual level. But you got to ask yourself, well, what's happening today, right in front of our eyes, especially in this country, is that there's so many people that are in the church that are now defecting, now going AWOL, or now they're not doing their job, all right? They're becoming lukewarm, apathetic, indifferent at a time when the church really, really, really needs to emphasize this need for commitment and for discipline and to really understand what we're dealing with here. I think that's why there's an emphasis as far as the number when it comes to the men of valor. But then it says also in this verse 6 of chapter 7 of 1 Chronicles, now he's going to be dealing with Benjamin. Now, Benjamin, he was the youngest son. And just keep this in mind, too, because when they came out of Egypt and they took the first census, Benjamin had 35,400 men of war, fighting men, right? But then after 40 years, Benjamin himself had an increase as far as fighting men, as 45,600. And my point is this. This tribe of Benjamin, I think it says a lot of what happened to them in their history, because it says this in verse 6 of 1 Chronicles chapter 7. It says, the sons of Benjamin were three, Bela and Becher and Jediael. The sons of Bela were five, Esbon, Uzai, Uzael, Jerimoth, and Ira. They were the heads of their father's household, mighty men of valor, and there were 22,034 enrolled by genealogy. You see what I'm saying? I mean, this is many years after they'd already been in their land, and here they're talking about 22,000, which, like I've said, if you go back to Numbers chapter 1, and then the Numbers chapter 26, I believe, and you make the comparison there, well, they had over 45,000 men of war then, but here it is, they're talking about 22,034. So I get the impression that they're not including all the men of draft age. It's just simply the ones that were enrolled in the army, right? And then he says in verse 8, the sons of Bichur were Zimriah, Joash, Eleazar, Eli-Enai, Omri, Jerimoth, Abijah, Anoth, and Elimeth. All these were the sons of Bichur. They were enrolled by genealogies according to the generations, heads of their father's household, 20,200 mighty men of valor. The sons of Jediel was Bilhan, and the sons of Bilhan were Jeus, Benjamin, Ehud, Chineah, Zenath, Tarshish, and Abhishar. All these were the sons of Dedeel, according to the heads of their father's household, 17,200 mighty men of valor, who were ready to go to war with the army to war. Suppim and Huppim were the sons of Ir. Hushim was the son of Aher. Now, one thing about this Benjamin that I think is very, very significant. It's been many, many years since we've been through the book of Judges, but there's a very, very, very sordid account there in the book of Judges and what happened to the tribe of Benjamin. And because it's over three chapters long, I'm obviously not going to read it. But that was a situation where you had a Levite who was from the tribe of Ephraim, and his concubine ran away from him, and she went down to Judah, all right, to stay with her father. And then this Levite decided he wanted his concubine back, so he goes down to his father-in-law, and then he stays there a few days, and he, you know, sweet-talks his concubine into coming back with him. Anyway, what happened there was that he kind of got delayed in returning back to Ephraim, and on the way he had to spend a night there in Gibeah. He had to spend a night there in one of the towns or the cities in Benjamin. And he got there with his concubine, and they were just going to sleep in the open square. And one of the older men came in, and he saw them there in the open square and said, "Man, you can't stay here." He says, "Come home with me." And anyway, long story short, when they went home with this old man and he gave them dinner and they were sitting around talking and chewing the fat, then what happened there was exactly the same thing that happened to Lot when he was entertaining the angels there. It says that the men of the city, of this particular city, had surrounded this guy's house and they were demanding to know this guy sexually. They were a roving band of homosexuals who were demanding to rape this man. And the older guy goes out there and says, "Don't do this wickedness, my brother. Don't do this. Don't do this." And then, I don't know what was wrong with this Levite, but to protect his own hide, he took his wife and just threw her out there to these people. And they ravaged her all night long. And then when this Levite goes out the next morning, you know, he just says to his wife, she's laying on the porch, "Get up, we're going." And then he realized she's dead. Now, here's what this guy did. He cut that woman into 12 pieces, and then he sent one portion of her body to every tribe of Israel. And then it got all the rest of the tribe of Israel down there to find out, why did this happen? And then he told them, okay, what these men of Gibeah did. So anyway, they looked to God as far as the Urim and the Thummim to try to determine what God would have them do. And God said, yeah, go to war with Benjamin, because they first went up to the city of Benjamin, one of the major cities, and said, give up these men who did this wicked deed. And Benjamin wouldn't give them up. So then they got embroiled in a civil war. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Israel lost something like 20,000 men the first day, 18,000 men the next day. Israel was really losing a great deal in this battle. Benjamin was really getting the upper hand. And then finally, the grandson, Phinehas, if I'm not mistaken, cast lots to determine what God wanted him to do. And God said, go up again this third day and I'll give it to you. I'll give you the victory. Anyway, long story short, Benjamin almost got completely decimated as a tribe. But then you got to step back and you got to look at what's happened here, and you got to ask yourself, well, this tribe of Benjamin, they wouldn't give up these men who did this wicked deed. But then you got to ask, well, when God tells the rest of Israel to go to war with Benjamin, and the rest of Israel gets the snot kicked out of them, and they lose thousands and thousands and thousands of men, you got to ask, well, why did God allow that to happen? Who can tell me?
They were just as wicked.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think they were.
In the sense that they didn't stand up against such
good
evil.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. I really believe what happened here. And believe me, this was, it didn't take very long when they got into their promised land. It only took a couple generations or so before this immorality had set in to such an extent that these men were now becoming roving bands of homosexuals raping people. And if you read that account in Judges, beginning with chapter 20, and you read about that civil war, well, what says a great deal to me is that it didn't take that long after they got into their land for this to disintegrate to this degree. And I get this impression, all right? First of all, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, refused to give these men up because of their wickedness. So in other words, they're going out of their way to protect these men. But I really believe that God used that whole situation to judge the entire nation of Israel, because Israel apparently had allowed this to disintegrate, this moral condition of their nation to disintegrate to this degree where this Levite cut up his concubine. Because if you read that account, you wonder, what's wrong with this man that he would mutilate his dead wife and then send off portions of her body, 12 different pieces of her body, to 12 different tribes?
Send them off how?
Well, through messengers. That's what it says. All right? He would send each one. I don't care whether it was the head or the torso or the arms or the legs, the feet, however he did it. Now, what does that tell you? Why did that guy go to such extremes to get a message across?
Just like us here, we're just so desensitized,
nothing
shocks us anymore.
Yeah, nobody in Benjamin or around had any care whatsoever, so he decided to go beyond that.
This is my take on it, and I really believe I'm right on this, all right? Is that this Levite knew, you know what, if I just send out a message by a messenger, just send a letter out to each tribe and tell them what happened here, and tell them they need to get down here and deal with this wickedness, Israel would just yawn. Oh, yawn. Ho-hum. But now he's got to shock them into doing the right thing. So I really believe that God judged that entire tribe of Israel because they allowed this to go on because of their apathy and their indifference. And now they got to that point. And then when you look at the tribe of Benjamin, instead of these guys, instead of this tribe giving up these men who were responsible for this, they're protecting them with their lives. Now, I know that I'm just going to receive a lot of, hatred for saying this, but I'm telling you, this is where we are at as a nation right now. We protect this lifestyle to the death, don't we? In other words, I'm talking about gay marriage, the homosexual agenda, the whole thing. How did we get to this point? We got to a situation where we simply were apathetic, indifferent towards it. And then we got to a point where we okayed it, right? And then we got to a point where we promoted it. And once you get to the point where now your laws and now you've promoted it, now you're promoting it, the next step is this. You vilify anyone who disagrees with it. That's where we're at. And that's where Israel had gotten. And take the same thing, let's just say, about abortion. Yeah, that's another hot button issue item that people would just hold me in contempt for even saying this, even suggesting this. Well, what happened there was God so severely judged the tribe of Benjamin that it got down to 600 men. Almost an entire tribe was wiped out. So I think there's something to be said when you're reading about this Benjamin. And matter of fact, when Jacob was pronouncing, you know, his blessings or his last words, he said that Benjamin would be a ravenous wolf. And sure as heck he was, right? But God judged him severely, and I guarantee you this is going to happen to this nation. And how did it all start? It starts with apathy and indifference and ho-hum, not concerned about the evil that's beginning to spread. And then the next thing you know, we really have to be shocked into doing the right thing. Then he says here in that verse 13, he deals with Naphtali. Now, Naphtali, you know, when Jacob was basically pronouncing his blessings or his last words and testimony to his sons in Genesis chapter 49, he said, Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Now, that was his prophecy in regards to Naphtali, all right, in regards to that particular son and that particular tribe. And all what's saying here in First Chronicles about Naphtali is that verse 13, the sons of Naphtali were Jaziel and Gunai and Jezer and Shalom, the sons of Billah. And all I can say here is, if you look at Naphtali on the map, Israel's map, it's right there. Can anybody see it right there on that map? What's right next to Naphtali? The Sea of Galilee is right smack in the very heart of Naphtali. And then what Jacob pronounced about Naphtali, you know, he said, Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Now, what could that prophecy mean? Let me ask you this. Where did Jesus Christ do most of his preaching and teaching and miracles?
Galilee.
It was right there in Naphtali, right? And that's where people saw a great light. But I think what's significant about that too is that Jesus Christ, he came down really hard and heavy upon his, basically his generation, especially people in that area there around that Galilee, Sea of Galilee, because that's where he performed most of his miracles. That's what he did most of his preaching and his teaching. And he really said to those people, hey, listen, he says, it's going to be more tolerable in the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah than it is going to be for his generation, because he said that the miracles had been done in Sodom, that Sodom would have remained to this day. And he said it's going to be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than it is going to be for the people of his generation. He gave an example of the Queen of Sheba coming from the ends of the earth, okay, to hear the wisdom of Solomon. He's saying there's somebody greater than Solomon here. And he said that the miracles had been done in Tyre and Sidon that had been done in his generation, he says it would remain to this day. In other words, people saw a great light there with Christ there, and it talked about him having these graceful words. That's what people witnessed. That's what people heard. But time and time and time again, what did Jesus Christ say? He says, let him who has an ear to hear, let him hear. And even though people were seeing and hearing this tremendous revelation from God in regards to Jesus Christ as the Son of God, he basically was rejected. So in that prophecy that in Genesis chapter 49 that Jacob made in regards to Naphtali, he says, Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Well, I think that was pointed to Jesus Christ. And now they're going to be dealing with the descendants of Manasseh. Manasseh, just keep this in mind, he was a son of Joseph. All right, he was his firstborn son. And Ephraim was his secondborn son. But Jacob actually adopted those two. And when Jacob was dying, he actually sat on the side of his bed and he crossed his hands and put his right hand on Ephraim and his left hand on Manasseh. And Joseph didn't like his father doing that, saying, hey, you got it mixed up here. Manasseh's the firstborn. He gets the first blessing. And Jacob said, no, he knew what he was doing. And he said that he would bless them both, but that Ephraim would become the greater tribe, which he did. And all I'm saying is this, if you look at this verse 14 of 1 Chronicles 7, it says, the sons of Manasseh were Asriel, whom his Aramean concubine bore. She bore Machir, the father of Gilead. Machir took a wife for Huppin and Suppin, whose sister's name was Makah, and the name of the second was Zelophehad. Zelophehad had daughters. Now, I don't know if you guys remember at all, but do you remember who Zelophehad was? When we went through the book of Numbers, I'll just refresh your memory there, because it was a situation where this guy named Zelophehad, he had these different daughters, but he had no sons. And, it says in Numbers chapter 26, verse 33, now Zelophehad, the son of Hefer had no sons, but only daughters, and the names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Malha, Noah, Hogla, Michal, and Tisa. How would you like to have a name, Hogla? But that's what one of his daughters' name. But then, this is what the daughter said to Moses one day, we're going to go into the promised land, because Zelophehad had no sons. And they felt like they were going to be basically having their inheritance taken from them. But they went to Moses in this Numbers chapter 27, and they said this: Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came there. And these are the names of the daughters: Mala, Noah, Hogla, Michal, and Tisa. They stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders of all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting, saying, Our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those gathered to themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. In other words, he was one of the ones that was weeping and crying and wailing and complaining about going into the promised land because of the giants and everything else. So he just died out there in the wilderness. Right, but they said he wasn't involved in the rebellion out there in the wilderness with Korah. In other words, his sin wasn't nearly as grave. All right, but he did die out there as a judgment. And now he has all only daughters. And his daughters were saying this: Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no sons? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. So Moses brought their case before the Lord. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, The daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. You shall surely give them an hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their fathers to them. Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, If a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brother. And if he has no brother, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And he goes on to say, you shall give it to, you know, the closest relative. But here's the thing. When they were dividing up the land, this is what's kind of interesting to me. In Deuteronomy chapter 36, it says this in regards to Zelophehad's daughters. It says this: And the heads of the father's household of the family of the sons of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of the sons of Joseph came near and spoke to Moses before the leaders of the heads of the father's household of the sons of Israel. And they said, The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land by lot to the sons of Israel as an inheritance. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But if they marry one of the sons of the other tribes of the sons of Israel, their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe which they belong. Thus, it will be withdrawn from our allotted inheritance when the jubilee of the sons of Israel comes, and their inheritance will be added to their inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. So their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. Now, I know this sounds really confusing, but let me just wind it down by saying this. He says this: Then Moses commanded the sons of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, The tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, Let them marry whom they wish, only they must marry within the family of the tribe of their father. Thus no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from the tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his father. Every daughter who comes into possession of an inheritance of any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be a wife of the one of the families of the tribe of her father, so that the sons of Israel each may possess the inheritance of the father. And my point is this, okay? I know that I'm just kind of rambling here, but when you're reading about this guy Zelophehad, he had nothing but daughters, but then his daughters were to get the inheritance. But then when they were dividing up the land, they had an objection to give it to his daughter, saying, well, what if the daughter, she was from the tribe of Manasseh, what if she married somebody from the tribe of Dan? Well, then her inheritance would end up going to the tribe of Dan. And God said this is the only way he would allow that. If a woman were to marry outside a tribe, she would forfeit her inheritance, right? But then, you know, the only way that she could keep it is to marry within the tribe. Okay, now I just want to take to the spiritual level real quick. Just take this to the spiritual level. See if you can think this through, or think deep about it and come up with an explanation. Let's just imagine, well, you don't have to imagine, because all these are God's people. But he's saying to the women, don't marry outside your tribe, because if you do, you're going to lose your inheritance. Now, apply that spiritually. Apply that today. How would it be when God says, don't marry outside the tribe? Apply it to today.
Don't marry a non-Christian?
Yeah. Well, no, not because they're all God's people here. But you're very close.
Different doctrine, even within the...
Yeah, you're hitting around it. This is a spiritual principle, all right? If you get, let's say, a Baptist and a Lutheran that marry together, they're both God's people, right? But God is saying this, for the sake of inheritance, sake of your children, you need to, you know, decide upon what church you're going to attend. And it's usually the head of the household that makes that decision. So that what happens? When your children are growing up, your father doesn't go to one church and your mother goes to another. Now, God doesn't want that. He wants basically this unity here. You see, I hope I'm not going over your head or beating this to death, but you can see the spiritual principle of that. Now, let's just wind this down because I know that I'm spending way too much time on this. But it says in verse 14 of 1 Chronicles 7, the descendants of Manasseh, he's talking about this Zelophehad. And he says in this verse 16, Makkah, the wife of Machir, bore a son, and she named him Peresh, and the name of his brother was Sherith, and his sons were Ulam and Rekham. The sons of Ulam were Bedan. These were the sons of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh. His sister, Hamolisith.
We're going to sit here until you get
okay. Hamolisith. Okay. His sister, Hamolisith, bore Ishod and Abizir and Mala. The sons of Maida were Hidan and Shechem and Lehi and Anim. Can't these people have names like Tom, Dick, and Harry, George, Bob? No, you gotta. Anyway, you like to slap their parents for naming these kids. But look at this name here. Look at this woman's name. Her sister, Hamolisith. I mean, man, it takes up the whole alphabet, you know. Well, anyway, they're here for a purpose. They're here for a reason. To do what? For what purpose? I really believe it's to do what? You know, it's very important that people understand what tribe they're from. Now, it may not seem important today, but if all you have to do is go back to the book of Revelation, and you can see that God has kept meticulous records of who belongs to what tribe, and you're going to see this happen during the millennial period when Jesus Christ is ruling and reigning, because we just finished up not that long ago the book of Ezekiel, and in that the last 8 chapters of that book, it talks all about this land that's going to be divided among the tribes of Israel, and everybody's going to know what tribe they're from. And then in verse 20 it says the sons of Ephraim were Shuleth and Bered his son, and Talith his son, and Elda his son, and Talith his son, Zabad his son, Shuleth his son, and Ezer and Eled, whom the men of Gath who were born in the land killed because they came down to take their livestock. Their father Ephraim mourned many days, and his relatives came to comfort him. Then he went into his wife, and she conceived and bore a son, and he named her Beriah because misfortune had come upon his house. His daughter was Shira, who built lower and upper Beth Horon, also Uzen Shira. Now, before we go any further, I just want to make this comment about this, because why would he throw this in here? But you're talking about some of the descendants of Ephraim, and it says here in that verse 21, Zabad, his son, Shuthiel, his son, and Ezer and Eled, whom the men of Gath, who were born in the land, killed because they came down to take their livestock. Now, what is that saying? Why is that put there? I get this impression. These two guys, and maybe even the four of them who were descendant of this particular man, they were cattle rustlers. They went down to steal livestock that didn't belong to them. And the farmers of that particular land, or the ranchers of that particular land in Gath, killed them. Now, all I can say is this. I think that's in there for, that should be pretty instructive to people. Look at how many people today, throughout history, but especially today, How many people are killed in the commission of a crime?
Quite a number.
Oh, you couldn't count them all, right? People who are killed in the commission of a crime. Now, that's really got to be a grief to any parent, right? Just imagine to yourself you're in the middle of committing a crime and then you're killed. And you're catapulted into the very presence of God. Man, that is a bad way to go, wouldn't you say? Because what did Solomon say in the book of Ecclesiastes? He says basically, you know, a day of one's death is better than a day of one's birth. But he's talking about a person who has a good name. That person, when they die, the day of their death is going to be better than the day of their birth. All right? That's what he's talking about. As a matter of fact, maybe I should just read that because... this is what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. A good name is better than a good ointment, and a day of one's death is better than a day of one's birth. In other words, if you have a good name, that the day you die is going to be better than the day you were born. Now tell somebody that. You know, the day you die is going to be better than the day you were born. You would think that that would be an insult. But for a person who has a good name, all right, that's going to hold true. And he says it's better to go into a house of mourning than to go into a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in a house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in a house of pleasure. And God is just simply saying this, you know what? It's far better to go into a funeral parlor and just sit there and look at that the individual laying there in a casket and think to yourself, you know what, that's going to be me one of these days. One of these days I'm going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground. Solomon says the wise person will do that. The fool will think, well, that's just morbid. That's stupid. Don't do that. But Solomon says it's better to go into a funeral parlor and really reflect upon the day of your death than to go to a party, go to a feast, just be whooping it up. All right? Because it really puts things in perspective when we can look at life through the spectacles of death. Because we're reading about these two guys who were from the tribe of Ephraim. They get caught red-handed stealing livestock, stealing cattle, and they get killed. All right, and then they leave their father brokenhearted, their family brokenhearted. You know, and where are these guys tonight? We're going to touch people with this life one way or the other. And when I say touch people, I don't mean pick their pocket, man. We need to touch people in a way that they, man, we make a difference in their life. All right. I know when I die, people probably want to dance in my grave, but I'm going to touch somebody one way or the other. You know what I'm saying? Well, these guys, you wouldn't want to die the way they did. And then he talks about this daughter, that verse 24, his daughter was Shira, who built the lower and upper Beth Horon, also using Shira. Now, he's talking about a daughter here who apparently it says he built this, I don't know, this town. All you say to me is that it's kind of unusual, but he talks about how what a difference his daughter made in comparison to two of his sons, or maybe even a few of his sons. His daughter really made something of herself in being industrious and being hardworking. And in other words, what I'm saying is this: God puts a tremendous premium upon being industrious. And this woman really exemplified herself, unlike her brothers. So even if you come from a family where you got a bunch of riffraff in it, you could still excel. And God, like I said, he puts a tremendous premium on being diligent and hardworking. And as a matter of fact, in Proverbs, twice he says, a little more sleep, a little more slumber, a little more folding of the hands of rest, and your poverty will break in on you like an armed man. And just apply that spiritually. A little more sleep, a little more slumber. I mean, just apply it spiritually. Just if we become more and more negligent in regards to our relationship with God, before we know it, little incremental steps at a time, we are going to be poverty stricken, spiritually speaking. But it's going to require a discipline. It's going to require effort. It's going to require work. In other words, you know, I think the best place to grow in our love and knowledge and fear of God, one of the best places is at a Bible study where you really take God's word serious, that you can really be built up in your faith. But then to do that, it's going to require a discipline. It's going to require a commitment. It's going to require, you know what, I'm going to have to turn off that Facebook, I'm going to have to turn off that computer, turn off that TV, and make the effort to come to Bible study. See, that takes a discipline, right? And God puts a tremendous premium upon that. But if we continue to hit the snooze button, continue to make excuses, continue to say, well, I can't go to Bible study, I got to watch this commercial or whatever the excuse is, what's going to happen to us spiritually, right? Well, this woman really exemplified herself. That's why I think it's put there. I mean, I don't know why else. I mean, it's pretty darn unusual, don't you think? Then he says in that verse 25, Repha was his son, along with Resheph and Tela, his son, Tanna, his son, Ladan, his son, Abimahud, his son, Elishima, his son, Nun, his son, and Joshua, his son. Their possessions and their settlement were Bethel and his town, and to the east, Naran, and to the west, Gezer and his towns, and Shechem with its towns, as far as Aiya with its towns, and along with the borders of the sons of Manasseh, Bethshean with its towns, and Tanish with its towns, and Megiddo with its towns, Dor with its towns, and these lived the sons of Joseph, the sons of Israel. Man, I'm telling you, I'm trying to get through this. I'm going to just wind this down because I know we're virtually out of time, but I want to deal with this Asher, the tribe of Asher, and I think it's kind of significant because it says the sons of Asher were Imnah, Ishva, Ishvi, and Berea, and Sarah, their sister. And by the way, when we were talking about in that verse 23 about Berea, his name means misfortune. That's why one of the sons that he named, because he lost two of his sons when they were rustling cattle. Well, there was a guy in Stalin's secret service whose name was Berea. And this guy was really referred to as somebody who was truly a misfortune for so many people because of all of their murderous methods of dealing with people. But interesting thing, that guy Berea under Stalin. When Stalin died, Berea thought that he was going to become basically the head of the Soviet Union, and they end up assassinating him. And I just say that in passing because I thought it was interesting that his name means misfortune, and you can even see how not that long ago there was a guy who was really a misfortune that he lived up to his name. And that verse 31, it talked about that sons of Berea were Heber and Malchiel, who was the father of Bizath. Heber became the father of Jaleth and Shomer and Hotham and Shua, their sister. The sons of Jaleth were Pesha and Bimhal and Ashva. These were the sons of Jaleth. The sons of Shemer were Ahai and Rogah and Jehuba and Aram. The sons of his brother Helam were Zophah and Imnah and Shelish and Amal. The sons of Zophah were Shua and Harbnifer, Shua, and Berai, and Imra, Bezer, Had, Shama, and Shilsha, Ithran, and Bera. The sons of Jether were Jephnue, Pispa, and Ara. The sons of Eula were Ara, Haniel, and Riza. These were the sons of Asher, the heads of their father's household, choice and mighty men of valor, heads of the princes, and the number of them enrolled by genealogy for service in war was 26,000 men. I want to just say this in passing, okay, about this tribe of Asher. Anybody remember in the New Testament where somebody was referred to as being from the tribe of Asher? I think it's kind of interesting that it says what happened when they presented Jesus Christ to be circumcised on the eighth day of after his birth. We're talking about Simeon.
Oh, that old man?
It wasn't the old man, but it says this in Luke chapter 2. It says this, and there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon, and this man was righteous and devout, looking for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him, and it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. And he came in the Spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus to carry out for him the custom of the law, then he took him into his arms and blessed God and said, "Now, Lord, you are releasing your bondservant to depart in peace according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light of revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel." And his father and his mother were amazed at the things which were being said about him. And Simeon blessed them and said to Mary his mother, "Behold, the child is appointed for the fall and the rise of many in Israel, and for a sign to be opposed, and the sword will pierce even to your own soul, to the end that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed." And there was, now listen to this, and there was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Pheniel, of the tribe of Asher. She was advanced in years and had lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage, and then as a widow to the age of 84. She never left the temple, serving night and day with fasting and prayers. At that very moment she came up and began giving thanks to God and continued to speak of him to all those who were looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. And I just read that because it talks about this prophetess named Anna who lived in the temple there for many, many, many years after she became a widow. And it says that she was from the tribe of Asher. Now, this is centuries, centuries after they had come back from their exile. So what it says to me is they did keep records and people knew what tribe. And not everybody, of course, because of everything that had been lost with the deportation and things like this. But I think it's kind of significant that they even mentioned her tribe. And then, like I said, during the tribulation period, God is going to basically anoint 144,000 Jews, and they're going to be broken up a core 12,000 towards each tribe. And then when Jesus Christ is ruling and reigning, then all the Jews are going to know exactly what tribe they're from, and they're going to be allotted land. Now, just looking at the overall pictures, God has a purpose for this. All right, and all I can do is just try to piece it together the best I can and say, hey, man, this is important for a particular reason that people know their tribe and know what tribe they belong to. And that applies to us today. We just got to flat out say, well, who do we belong to? I mean, if we don't belong to Jesus, believe me, we're in the wrong tribe. You know what I'm saying? Anybody have anyone to add or share?